I'd give anything if that little red-haired girl had sent me a valentine.
Hey, maybe she did send me one. Maybe it's in our mailbox right now.
I'm afraid to look.
If I look and there's nothing there, I'll be crushed. I've got to look.
Maybe Charlie Brown will get his valentine when the postman remembers to get his free 26-point inspection at Perfection Auto Works. In fact, we define it as an act of love worthy of St. Valentine's. To get your spouse's car fixed, maintained, and running right, with a call to 323-8650 and a click to perfectionautoworks.com. That's 323-8650. From an oil change to a major service, foreign or domestic, since 1994, Perfection Auto Works has been giving you the love at 323-8650.
This is America's Fabric, a program about the cultural beliefs and foundations of our exceptional country. The program you're about to hear will help connect those beliefs and foundations to today's society. The program is paid for by the America's Fabric Organization, funded by individual sponsorship. Here is your host for today's program.
President Trump says he wants the U.S. to control the Panama Canal and other regions and waterways that he says are crucial to America's national security interests.
Worst case scenario for the United States would be that they would find a way to disrupt the Panama Canal so that the United States no longer has rapid reaction capabilities to be able to move from the Atlantic into the Pacific.
Joseph Heumeier is an expert on Latin America and asymmetric warfare. He breaks down the context of Trump's recent comments and how vulnerable the U.S. is to increasing Chinese, Russian, and Iranian influence in the region.
The United States has not had a grand strategy for the Western Hemisphere, arguably since the Monroe Doctrine.
And I'm Yanya Kelly. Joseph Heumeier, President Trump seems like he really wants to control the Panama Canal and perhaps Greenland as well at almost any cost. What's your take?
So I think this is mostly a national security conversation. Obviously, there's some economic dimensions. Obviously, there's negotiation aspects to any kind of discussion that's had with partners and allies. But I think fundamentally what President Trump is doing is he's beginning a conversation about our near abroad, something that's been sorely lacking in U.S. foreign policy. Throughout the 21st century, or you can even go back to a large part of the 20th century, U.S. foreign policy has focused on just about every part of the world except the one in which we live. We trade the most, the one we travel the most, the one we have probably the most affinity. And I think President Trump has understood that there's no way to protect the homeland if your outer perimeter is breached.
Does China control it?
China, the largest, is the more serious adversary to our security. And I think the fact that China has breached that perimeter, both through Latin America and through the Arctic and Canada, is a serious concern for U.S. national security interests. So I think what President Trump is positioning here is the United States and our national security interests in our near abroad. And that doesn't necessarily always have to be a negotiation, because some things are non-negotiable. Like, we're not going to allow the United States to get attacked. And if Russia or China or any bad actor wants to potentially position themselves to launch any kind of kinetic attack on the United States, we need to get well ahead of that and make sure that that's neutralized and not possible. So everything from the Arctic and Greenland's part of that, all the way down to the Panama Canal, is part of that perimeter. I think there's another conversation, that, including the perimeter, but it's kind of broader, is the conversation about strategic waterways. And I think the Arctic is a strategic waterway because of the Northern Passage. But in a matter of a couple of decades, it'll be probably one of the most, if not the most, strategic waterway, as being an interpolar sea route for the first time being able to go from the North Pole to the South Pole. China has been positioning itself, along with Russia, to be able to control that route into the future. Everyone understands the importance of the Panama Canal. Our history books talk about the Panama Canal, but that's the problem. It's stayed in the history books. It hasn't moved into the present, and China has been quietly and silently encroaching on the Panama Canal. Do they control the canal? Can they shut down the canal? And those questions don't always get a black and white response. The reality is China every day has that much more influence over the operations of the canal and Panama itself. Panama does not like to talk about that because they have a lot of trade and a lot of commerce with China. But fundamentally, they know that that's the case. And the question with China is, when you talk about commercial enterprises, companies, you're fundamentally talking about military ambitions. China blends the two together. They have a military-civil fusion strategy. They have the ability to use dual-use companies. And I think that that's something that is lost sometimes among Latin Americans, the policymakers and politicians. Let's do a little bit of history. So the canal is in many ways an extension of the Monroe Doctrine that was signed in 1823. Many people, especially academics, have this kind of misconception or misperception about the Monroe Doctrine, thinking it's an interventionist or imperialistic U.S. foreign policy. Latin America is ours. It's not. It was a defensive posture. And matter of fact, one of the main architects of the Monroe Doctrine, obviously President James Monroe, was his Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams. And if anyone has read or learned about John Quincy Adams, he was absolutely not an interventionist. I think his famous saying was, "Let not search for monsters to destroy." He was very much a restraint on foreign adventures. The Monroe Doctrine was a statement at a time by a burgeoning power. The United States was not a world power yet, to say that the new world is off limits to old ways of governing, the monarchs from the Europe in the past. And it was a time that we didn't really know how that was going to play out. But now we do. And what happened after the Monroe Doctrine was signed in 1823 was the burgeoning of sovereign nations in Latin America. Many of these countries probably would never reach their sovereignty had it not been for the Monroe Doctrine and the rise of the United States as a world power. So that takes us to the Panama Canal, which was effectively built in 1903. But prior to the Panama Canal, it wasn't the United States' idea. It was actually the French idea to build the Panama Canal. They sent a lot of French engineers, except they had a lot of trouble. The French engineer that initiated the Panama Canal construction had just built the Suez Canal over in Egypt. And he thought that this was going to be very similar and we're going to be able to use the same technology and engineering. And what he found out is terrain matters, and it's very different desert to a swamp jungle, which is Panama. And the elevation of Panama from the sea route was very difficult to traverse. So they lost a lot of time, money, and lives constructing the canal, and by 1895, pretty much abandoned the effort, except for one of the French individuals that decided that he wanted to persist and began this conversation with the United States about this opportunity to finish the Panama Canal. At the time, Panama was actually a province of Colombia. The map looked different. It was called the Greater Colombia, which is where Panama is today. And so we approached Colombia to make an offer. I believe the offer was about $10 million annual and then a certain amount of perpetuity to be able to construct the canal and administer it. And the Colombian government approved this offer, but the Colombian Senate did not. The deal was shut down, and we were back to square one. But then a rebellion happened, and it was a Panamanian separatist movement lifted up with the United States support, and they became an independent republic. And I tell that to signify how important the canal is to the identity of Panama as a nation. So the birth of their republic of Panama, their independence from Colombia, is tied to the creation of the Panama Canal. As soon as they became an independent republic, they gave the concessions to the United States to build it. And our engineers, particularly one engineer named John Stevens, is really the brilliance behind building that canal. Because what the French couldn't do with their engineering, we were able to accomplish. If you go visit the canal, that same technology exists about the ability to raise the water levels to open a series of locks to be able to traverse this kind of mountain that's tied to the sea, the access to the sea routes. So that engineering was 120 years ago, was brilliant at the time. It's still brilliant today. It needs some improvements and expansions. That's the beginning starting point of the canal, which takes us to the treaty signed in 1979 and then effectively transferred in 1999.
What's happening with this treaty?
The treaty was signed by President Jimmy Carter, and it was a hot-button issue at the time in the United States. And it had to do with President Carter's vision at the time of trying to change the image of the United States as less of an imperialist power, less of an interventionist country, and more of a one that can have a kind of a community with our allies. And so in that, there was a discussion about the canal. The reason I mentioned the 60s was because that's where the movement inside Panama to resist the canal started to bubble up. We had a military presence in Panama at the time. The canal zone was actually a military base by the United States. It started actually with a student protest. A student protest stood up, protested the presence of the United States military in Panama, and then that kind of started to create a narrative inside Panama and extensively into the United States about potentially transferring the canal to Panama. That happened prior to Jimmy Carter becoming president. Matter of fact, when Jimmy Carter was campaigning, he actually said he would not sign over the canal. He won the election and he changed his mind. And then he signed the treaty. And what the treaty says is that there's a period of about 20 years in which the United States will gradually turn over the operations of the Panama Canal to the Republic of Panama, but with conditions. And those conditions had to do with neutrality. And this is actually a separate agreement from the actual treaty to turn over the canal. And the neutrality agreement has to do with the ability of not having any one country have complete dominance and control over the canal, particularly countries that are hostile to the United States. And it says that inside the treaty. Actually, it has a thing called the De Concini Clause. It's one of the clauses inside the neutrality treaty that talks about any hostile powers to the United States having any type of control or influence over the canal. That brings us to today, because right before the canal was fully transferred in 1999, 2 years prior, Hutchison Whampoa, a port company from China, made a bid to get concessions to operate a couple of the ports on the canal. They won that concession, and so they timed it perfectly, because right before the transfer happened, they were able to start to operate ports, and all throughout the period of where Panama became fully in control of the canal, China has quietly, incrementally began to have more and more influence. I heard President Trump say in some of his statements or maybe some of his postings, the Chinese military are on the Panama Canal, and that drove a bit of a discussion in Panama. Well, the reality is that's a very advanced understanding of how Chinese companies operate. Hutchison Whampoa, for all its private sector activities and enterprise, as we know very well, has supported the PLA. Li Ka-shing particularly has known to be a logistical service provider for the PLA. So it's not a stretch when you say that there are Chinese military operating the canal. It may not be what people visualize, a Chinese PLA soldier operating the canal, but they're influenced by the People's Liberation Army and the national security apparatus of China.
Since we filmed this episode a few days ago, the Panama Maritime Authority announced they will be conducting an audit of the Hong Kong-based port operator CK Hutchison Holdings, which controls ports at the Panama Canal.
Could you explain this doctrine of military-civil fusion the Chinese use?
What China does, and I think kind of envisioned the private sector, is as a ways and means to an end. And that end doesn't have to do with commercial productivity. It has to do with military ambitions. It has to be positioning Chinese military throughout the world. I think China understands, just like any strategist would understand, that the waterways in the world are what's really most important. I mean, the United States becomes a superpower, along with our U.S. Navy, being able to provide maritime security throughout the world. So China's ambitions to be able to replace the United States as that superpower has a lot to do with being able to position themselves throughout the world in terms of maritime routes. They know that they don't have the kind of conventional muscle to flex with their military, at least not yet, so they use commercial enterprise. And so the military civil fusion strategy has to do with dual-use operations. Companies that have a commercial application that do port, construction, telecommunications, or whatever commercial endeavor, but have a dual use with military applications as well. And so in the case of the canal, and it's not just the Hutchison Whampoa, the operators of the port, the holding companies that are on those ports, but it's also the construction companies. So the canal has gone through an expansion, effectively began around 2014, 2015, and became operational around 2019. That expansion was done in large part to contracts given to Chinese construction companies. Chinese construction companies that were operating those are both state-owned companies that are known to be very close to the People's Liberation Army. That is a good example of their military civil fusion strategy, because these companies kind of literally paved the road for future ambitions that their military would undertake.
So you're saying this neutrality is being encroached upon.
What the last couple of years have shown is that there's potential instability. There's mass migration coming into Panama that's destabilizing the country. There's a drought that happened last year that really severely tested the limits of the Panama Canal. There's political corruption and money laundering and just all kinds of financial shenanigans that have been played out that really have given Panama a bad rap, because it's not necessarily all tied to Panama, but it's Panama is a financial center. And all this has basically manifested itself into a situation where the question is drawn, what happens if Panama falls? Like, what happens if the government becomes a Venezuela? What happens if narco traffickers take over? We had those questions actually in the 1980s, which is why the United States invaded Panama, right? Because the president of Panama at the time, Manuel Noriega, was a narco trafficker. And there was a concern that he would turn over the Panama Canal to drug traffickers. So we made sure that that didn't happen. I'm not saying that we're at that point today, but I think history serves as a lesson. And we want to make sure that that's not going to happen. And so the China question falls into that equation. You know, what is China's true intention with the Panama Canal? Now, you can't just ask China that openly in an interview, but that's an intelligence question, a strategy question, it's a policy question. It's a question that we need to have with allies. And one point on that, because I've heard this, people say, well, but why treat allies with that kind of aggressiveness? Well, my response to that is, who else are you going to have the conversation with? If this was an adversarial nation, which would be a lot worse, it's hard to have that conversation with an adversary, because the adversary doesn't necessarily care about your interests or necessarily have the same strategic ends that they want to get to. If you cannot talk with your allies about things of strategic importance, then what can you talk about with your allies?
There's no scenario where an adversarial power has make the rules about what happens there that the U.S. could accept.
That's right. And just so your audience knows how important it is to the United States, important to the world, first, it's 7%, upwards of 7%, 6%, 7% of global shipping. It's one of the seven major strategic waterways choke points throughout the world. But for the United States in particular, it's even more important. It's upwards of 40% of our container traffic and upwards of 70% of anything that comes and goes from U.S. ports. In fact, a lot of the commercial traffic that goes from the eastern seaboard of the United States, largely from New York and Baltimore, that traverses to go to the west coast of the United States, California, goes through the Panama Canal. That's the most efficient route. Otherwise, it would have to go all the way through the bottom of South America, which would almost double the transit time, maybe even triple the cost of that kind of trade. It would affect our economy substantially more than it would affect anywhere else in the world. That's the strategic, but also a military importance to the canal. But it did enable the two-ocean navy. It did enable us to be able to have transit of military vessels from the Atlantic side to the Pacific side much more expeditiously. In fact, during World War II, it was vital. The ability to get our navy to go into the Pacific to be able to deter Japan. Panama Canal was the most vital national asset. In fact, Imperial Japan had plans to attack the canal, as did the Nazis, by the way, plans to attack the canal, understanding that that's a strategic choke point that would severely limit the United States' military maneuvering. Back to current day, I don't think there's a circumstance that exists where the United States will allow that to happen, especially not under President Trump. I don't think there's a condition where we would say, and have it all controlled by China, and we're just going to be okay with that. Like, why did we even let this happen? And that kind of thing says a lot about some of our failures in U.S. foreign policy. But if anything we're learning about President Trump is he's correcting a lot of that. He's looking at the map and he's saying that this was, even if it's not conventionally popular, he's realizing that these are things that should have never happened and we have to correct that. And he stated it in his posting. He said President Jimmy Carter's treaty that transferred the canal to the Panama was a foreign policy blunder, a mistake. I don't think that that should have ever happened. There was actually a debate about that back then.
But it was reaffirmed recently, wasn't it? I mean, the U.S. in effect reaffirmed that.
I think you may be talking about the concessions to the port holding companies by China. China initially bid to operate these two ports on the canal. So the canal is a series of five ports, and the two outer ports, both on the Caribbean side and on the Pacific side, the holding companies are Chinese companies. And the bidding started in 97, and in effect, China won the concession for 25 years. And so that expired in 2022, 2023. And we had an opportunity then, the Biden administration had an opportunity then, to stop it, to say, okay, they lived out their concession, 25 years, they've been operating those sides of the canal, well, that's done. But unfortunately, there was nothing done effectively on it, so China bid again for another 25 years, and they won another concession. So that's where we're at today. We're at a situation where, unless we do something now, China has control at least of these two ports. And I want to make a point on that, because people talk about, well, the ports are not operated by China. There's the holding companies, they do the administrative support. The actual, if you go to those ports, it's Panamanians that are operating those ports on the canal. Correct. They're not Chinese operators on the canal. They're holding companies. But even if you go beyond that, you go to construction companies. They're building a bridge that traverses through the Panama Canal, the electrical grid, the water management system. These are all Chinese companies. Yes, they're contractors to the Panamanian government. But going back to our military civil fusion strategy discussion, to what level of transparency? And that's the big question. And that's the question we would have to have with Panama. Do you truly verifiably know everything that China is doing in regards to your canal for national security concerns? Unless they could give us an answer of 100% we do, I think that we're going to have more transparency on that. And I think that that's what the conversation is at today.
What do people in the region think about all this?
A couple things. Immediately when President Trump made the statement, first they say, I think it caught a lot of people by surprise. I thought it was a great opportunity for Panama and Latin America because, you know, every country wants to get on the agenda of the United States. I think head of state wants to visit the United States and they have a lot of interests and their own agendas. Panama, I don't know where it was, but it certainly probably wasn't in the top five, but now it is. It's a very privileged position to be in the top five of U.S. foreign policy interests, and this is an opportunity to you to bring your agenda, the president's prerogatives and priorities.
So Panamanian leadership is thinking to themselves, aha, we have an opportunity here.
I think they should be thinking about this. I think that they should approach this as an opportunity because this is a discussion that allows them to elevate Panama's role in U.S. foreign policy. The rest of the region depends. A significant part of the region that is trying to work against the United States in different regards. Some of them came out very vocal in support of Panama and trying to condemn the United States for being imperialistic. Kind of ironic because one of the first countries that I remember that made a statement was the president of Colombia, President Gustavo Petro. And that's a sore spot for Panama because a lot of Colombians kind of joke, or maybe some more than joke, that Panama really still just a province of Colombia. So when the Panamanians heard the president of Colombia, who's not an ally of the president of Panama, kind of become very vocal, they were like, okay, thank you, but no thank you. Like, we don't necessarily need you to make this any more difficult. There was, by that kind of crowd of the more leftist leaders in Latin America, a narrative that they're trying to spin up about the United States' imperialistic ambitions. but most people in Latin America kind of get it. President Trump has his manner of communicating, but fundamentally what he's talking about here is national security. And I think the people of Panama, who I think were a little bit in shock in the beginning, over time will start to realize that this has to do with their well-being as well. Correlation is not causation, but from the time that China began to really increase its presence in Panama, which is about 2017, when they began to politically maneuver inside Panama more than they did economically, you could just see Panama disintegrate little by little. More economic uncertainty. Obviously, the pandemic did not help them. And fundamentally, Panama today in 2025 is not as strong as it was in 2015, 10 years ago. I mean, Panama at one point was growing 10% a year. It was considered the Miami of Latin America. It was a great tourist destination. Many prominent celebrities were buying houses. And today, it's a shell of that. And like I said, correlation is not causation. But we do look at that inflection point in 2017 where the Panamanian government abandoned Taiwan in favor of the PRC, where they were the first country to sign the Belt and Road Initiative in Latin America, where China increased its diplomatic presence inside the city. And so fundamentally, there's a correlation between that period and where we are today.
So there's something in The Economist. The headline is, Marco Rubio will find China is hard to beat in Latin America. Subtitle, China buys lithium, copper, and bull semen and doesn't export its ideologies attached. Whereas China just says, you know, give us the stuff.
Most Latin American governments have that perception that China is just easier to work with. It comes with all these demands and conditions. The United States is much more transparent in what it wants and what it needs. And sometimes what it wants and what it needs honestly don't align with our U.S. national interests. Like I think in recent years, you had more like ideological things that were being imposed on Latin American countries tied to this woke mindset of gender ideology or gender equality that were being promoted aggressively in predominantly Catholic nations, which I don't think had any success. In fact, probably offended many of our friends down south. The difference here is fundamentally the transparency, because China says that they don't have conditions. They'll say, we don't care. But if you start to look in over time, they tend to meddle quite a bit in the internal affairs of these nations. They just don't do it very vocally. They don't talk about it. But in practicality, they're involved.
Watch what happens when the country acts in some way that's very obviously against the interests of the Chinese regime.
So this idea that they don't have conditions, I think, is a bit of a false nomer. They don't have transparent conditions. They don't actually list their conditions. They don't talk about their conditions. But when you cross a line that China does not like, they will absolutely let you know, and they will impose their will, and they'll play political warfare inside these countries. And I think now China's been for more than 20 years, but I'd say really aggressively in the last 10 years, and I think that that's starting to take shape inside the region.
They cite a former Argentinian minister. He says, with China, ideology is clearly in second place. We are lithium, copper, and food for them. It's very depersonalized.
And I think that China has a kind of sort of sales pitch, if you will, similar in Africa, partially in the Middle East as well, with this idea of that we're here and all we want to do is help buy your commodities and help create commercial agreements. We have a large population, give you access to our consumer markets. And they make it, you know, very attractive. But in reality, and I think this is something that I think most Latin Americans missed, is the way China's economy is developed, it's not stable in terms of the consumer market. There's a lot of volatility in their economy. But more importantly, as their economy has more trouble or contracts even, their defense industry continues to grow. A lot of these raw materials, whether it's lithium, rare earths, aren't necessarily just to feed a growing economy. It's to feed a growing defense industry. And I think that that's something that many countries, I don't think, really understood at the onset. And that fundamentally would bring these countries into a geopolitical alignment that could cause tension and problems in their country. I don't think any country in Latin America wants to be in the middle of a trade war or any kind of war between the United States and China. But fundamentally, China is going to suck them into that war if they continue to basically build their economic leverage and coercion over these countries. So I think in that sense, that the statement that was made by that Argentine minister is a little bit naive in the respects to what China truly is trying to acquire.
They're also very happy to enrich people who are going to be helpful to them and get their deals done.
That's what's called elite capture. So you go into any one of these countries, and Latin America is no different, and you have a host of families. Both have economic and business influence. Some become political influence. Others have influence through industry. And China does a great survey. They spend a lot of time surveying the what I call the social cultural conditions of these countries to understand what makes the levers move. You know, they have this kind of common saying in Latin America that there's always 12 families that control any one of these countries. So you got to identify those 12 families. 12 is not a really big number, so you can really get that. In reality, some cases there's a lot more families. In other cases, it may be closer to 12. But nonetheless, I think once you understand that network, and most importantly, understand the history. Because if there's a prominent family in any of these countries in Latin America, it's more likely because their genealogy is tied to either the founding, could be tied to their independence, could be tied to the, when the Spanish colonial rule. You understand the history, you understand the present-day network, you can actually make moves. The challenge there is that how do you make it strategically relevant, right? Because we had wars in the Middle East, obviously there's a lot going on in Asia, now we have wars in Eastern Europe. So all this is happening, and as my friends in special operations used to tell me, Joseph, we get it. There's headaches in Latin America, but we have migraines in other parts of the world, migraines in the Middle East. And so I think the border really started to wake up a lot of folks because what's happening in this country, and I think President Trump knows that better than anybody, but the American people, I think, understand that. And that's one of the reasons I think that President Trump was elected. I think that's one of his mandates. And so that border conversation has now, through President Trump's leadership, extended through a regional conversation. And in that, I think we're starting to talk about grand strategy. United States has not had a grand strategy for the Western Hemisphere, arguably in 100 years, arguably since the Monroe Doctrine. I think that was the last time we really started to talk about it. It's kind of encoded in our strategic DNA. Our founding fathers talked a lot about the hemisphere. And as a matter of fact, Jefferson and George Washington famously talked about non-foreign entanglements. Jefferson talked about Europe to be able to strengthen the hemisphere. Obviously, James Monroe. But I think that DNA translated into the 20th century with a lot of repeated attempts, FDR's good neighbor policy, JFK's Alliance for Progress. We even had President Reagan and his containment policy of communism in the Central America. And even the trade deals with NAFTA and other trade deals with the Bush administration. But all that really were good policies without any real action, without any real initiative. And I think President Bush Jr. would have done more in Latin America had it not been for 9/11. But I think the reality is in the 21st century, the United States has abandoned Latin America more than probably any other point in history. So I think what President Trump's doing is he's now redesigning this idea for a grand strategy. So when you do grand strategy, it's not only about looking at the political situations inside these countries. When you do grand strategy and when you do geopolitics, you look at geography. And when you look at geography in Latin America, you start to realize that there's specific, very key areas that are vital to U.S. national interests. I think second is a containment strategy of essentially access denial of these hostile actors. I think someone told me when I talked about this security perimeter and what I call a greater North America, right? When I talk about these concepts, they say, well, you have a problem there. So what's the problem? I say, we have at least three countries there that hate the United States and want to do us harm, Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. So would they agree of being part of this now new North American project? And I say, well, maybe they won't. But fundamentally, the conversation that we need to have with those countries isn't about whether they agree with us or disagree with us. It has to be like, you want to be a dictator, you want to violate human rights, you want to repress your opposition. You can't do that with Chinese weapons, Iranian weapons, Russian armament. That's the conversation. And I believe that if we can cut off the supply lines to those countries from those external actors, they become infinitely weaker than what they are today. So I would like to see the United States look at Latin America from a strategic perspective. I think President Trump has well positioned the United States for this. I think.
Thank you for listening to America's Fabric. This program is paid for by approximately half commercial sponsors. The great ones, Perfection Auto Works has been our longest. More recently, Wilkinson Wealth Management, and of course, Tucson Coin and Autograph. The other half is paid for by you. And please prayerfully consider if you'd like to support this program being a sponsor. You can do so by sending a check to America's Fabric, care of KVOI Radio, 3222 South Ritchie, Tucson, Arizona, 85713. Again, America's Fabric, care of KVOI, 3222 South Ritchie, Tucson, Arizona, 85713.
Perfection Auto Works knows that no one wants auto repair for Valentine's Day. People say it's just not sexy. Well, I'm here to tell you that it is, because your wife doesn't just drive a Porsche or a Mercedes, she wears it. You had the good taste to buy her that car. Now,
have the good taste to take it to a great shop. Perfection Auto Works, 323-8650.
This is Seth at Tucson Coin and Autograph. The 1864 2-cent piece is the first coin to have "In God We Trust" on it, and the 1935 G-Series silver certificate, which was actually printed in 1961, the first banknote to have "In God We Trust" on it. The coin to show that God was on the side of the North for the Civil War. Tucson Coin and Autograph at the southeast corner of Oracle and Orange Grove.
Or on the web at TucsonCoinandAutograph.com.
219-4427.
This is Eb Wilkinson with Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. What does it mean to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired? It means designing a plan that allows you to do the things you want to do, outpace inflation, and never run out of money in your lifetime. If you want to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired, call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's 777-1911 or WilkinsonWealthMGMT.com.